Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Tell Them a Story when we come back. You know, those who already walk submissively will say that there's no cause for alarm, but submissiveness is not our heritage. The First Amendment was designed to allow rebellion to remain as our heritage. The Constitution was designed to keep government off the backs of the people, and the Bill of Rights was added to keep the precincts of belief and expression of the press, of political and social activities, free from government surveillance. Now, you know, I wished I'd have thought of that, but that quotation comes from Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. Now, our princes and our politicians beller in the halls of Congress for more taxes, more spending, and more gun control, but you and I haven't heard anything intelligent come out of a politician's mouth in more than 75 years. And that's why I contend that the only real reason, logic, or common sense left in America comes from our courts. It doesn't come from our political process, our politicians, our lawyers, or our bureaucrats. Old Mayor Rothschild, I think, summed it up with a flair when he said, "You give me the money power, and I care not who makes the laws." Well, let me echo that by saying, "You give me the judicial power, and I care not who makes the laws either," because the real power in America is in our courts. It's not in our politics. Now, if you'd like to tap into that power of the courts, then why don't you call us here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. And best of all, it's free. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure. Our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, georgegordon.org. And you can click onto our archives page and download that free general law CD package right there off of our webpage. That's georgegordon.org, and then go to our archives page. All right, let's take a look at another story over here. Oftentimes, people will call the law school and they'll say, "Our courts are corrupt. Our politics are corrupt. Everything, there's corruption everywhere. There's corruption on Wall Street, and there's corruption here and there and one thing and another." And I don't deny that. You know, hell, I can see corruption going on everywhere. But I think that the corruption in the courts, especially our lower courts, that are dealing with things, you know, like the routine, mundane legal problems that you and I have down here at the local level, you know, things like the divorce court and the traffic court and the small claims court and Judge Judy and all the rest, I don't think that we've got near as much corruption down here at the lower level as you might think. And I'll tell you what my observations are, and I'll tell you a little story as we progress along. I've got a book in front of me here. It's called Legal Quotes. Legal Quotations. It was written by a fellow by the name of Frohingen. I think that's the way to pronounce his name, back in 1966. It's spelled Walter M. Frohmegen. So I'm going to say it's Frohmegen, back in 1976. And I don't think it's copyrighted. I've never seen it anyplace else. I don't even know where I got it, but somebody gave it to me, probably some patriot group somewhere. And so I've put it in my strategy and procedures book here, Chapter 5, and it's got 388 entries in it, and I thought I'd read some of these entries to you and tell you a little story here about the judicial system and what you can expect from it. It is true that judges from time to time are found to be taking bribes and that they're corrupt. I think you'll find more corruption in the political process, where we have open bribery called campaign contributions. And it is certainly true that the judiciary is in the process of being corrupted. For instance, in Texas, just to name one state out of many, the Supreme Court justices are elected. And because they're elected, they have to raise campaign money. They've got to raise some money to put ads on the television and so on. And so the big corporations fund those judges as they're running for office. And because of those judges being funded and running for office, the big corporations, you know, like Halliburton and BP and so on, for instance, you can just about bet that on this blowout that's occurred down here in the Gulf of Mexico, that when that thing comes to litigation, like the Exxon Valdez, you know, that ran aground and spilled oil, well, the decision up in Alaska was to fine or penalize the Exxon Corporation $5 billion for that wreck. The actual number that came out after all the appeals were over, I think it was $564 million, a little over $500 million, or about one-tenth, you know, round number, maybe 11-12% of the amount that was actually awarded. And I wouldn't doubt for a minute that it was the campaign money and et cetera that got our Supreme Court to vote that way. Now, there could have been some other extraneous legal issues involved there, but I kind of doubt it. So when you say, hey, wait a minute, our courts are corrupted over there, well, there is some corruption there. I don't deny that. But that doesn't mean that every judge in America now is corrupt and that every judge in America does not judge righteous judgment. God, in Deuteronomy chapter 1, charged our judges and said, you're not to respect persons, and you're to judge righteous judgment. Now, by and large, my experience has been that judges do that down here at the lower level. Now, there's some favoritism, and there's some ignorance that goes on. There's all kinds of human factors that come into the equation. They don't follow the Ten Commandment model to start with. But overall, and by and large, it's a system that has evolved over hundreds of years, and indeed, even thousands of years, and the system actually works pretty well. And I'm not disappointed with it. I'm in litigation now. I got three litigations working right now at the same time. And I'm not disappointed with the judicial system as it's operating. It could be better. I think that if we followed the scriptural model closer, I think we'd get better results. But the model that we're following follows the scriptural procedure, you know, pretty well. It's not 100% by any stretch of the imagination, but there's a lot of principles of our Ten Commandment model that are used in our judicial system today. And the judicial system does, in fact, work. It provides property settlements and contract disputes and all of those things, like Judge Judy needs to solve these little problems that come up. Moses was involved in the judicial system early on. You'll read about that in the Bible. And his father-in-law, Jethro, comes up to him one day and says, hey, you can't solve every problem that comes up. That's impossible. You need to appoint righteous men as judges so that they can judge these little matters, and then you can judge the bigger matters. Now, in the scripture, there's actually a day of the year called the Day of Atonement, which is a judicial holiday, Day of Atonement. And God would sit in the Holy of Holies in the temple on the Day of Atonement, and the high priest would bring in some judicial matters that needed to be resolved. These are called judgments. And God would judge that matter. There's an example of it in Numbers chapter 35 or 36, where there's six girls, and there's an inheritance problem that comes up, and then there's a judgment that comes out of that, and then we follow that judgment. The system that we have is derived from the scriptures, derived from the Bible. Now, my first observation of that came when I asked a lawyer friend of mine what the common law was and what he knew about it. And he said, well, I didn't know too much about it. We don't use it much anymore today. There's still some vestiges of it hanging around. But he said, why don't you go to Blackstone's commentaries? That led me to Coke, Cooley, and Kent. And I discovered in Blackstone that there were a lot of biblical principles of law that are being used in Anglo-Saxon administration, hell clear back in the King George days, that have been extrapolated into law today. For instance, when a man joins the army, he doesn't join the army for 2 years. It appears like he does because he goes off and he comes back 2 years later. Actually, when you join the army, you join for six. And that's because no Hebrew can be held to servitude for more than 6 years. In the seventh year, he must be free unbought. And this is why we, to this day, when we have military service, it's for 6 years. That's 2 years active, 2 years inactive, and 2 year reserve. That's the way that works. And then in the seventh year, you're unbought, and then you're free. You say, well, the monetary system, you know, that we adopted, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin or tender in payment of debt. Hell, we're still practicing that today. Just because most of you people out there are using bank accounts and credit cards doesn't mean we don't have the biblical monetary system that was set up by Moses at Mount Sinai in Leviticus 19, 35, and 36, extrapolated by our founding fathers at Article 1, Section 10, and is still in operation today pursuant to Title 31, Section 5101 through 5112 of the U.S. Code. I mean, hell, we're still doing that today. A case came out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals here some years back that deals with a gold clause case. Gold. Oh, I got a book right here in front of me, my private business book. Let me see if I can find that case for you. And I think it's right here with a paper currency or monetary system. Let me see if I'm right. And the case was called, I'll take that back. It has to do with checks. Let me see if I can find my check section here. No, I can't. Anyway, coming out, I'll tell you the story. I can't put my finger right on the case itself. But the story goes like this. In 1912, a guy wants to build a building, so he builds a building 12 stories tall. In 1917, he leases it on a 99-year lease for $12,000 a year in U.S. gold coin. Now, that lease won't be up until 2017. Well, in 1933, House Joint Resolution 192 comes along, which forbids the collection of gold coin. Government brings in the gold, and we go off of the gold standard, and so now the lease is paid in $20 bills instead of $20 gold pieces. This goes on to 1986. By now, there's an insurance company, American Casualty and Life Insurance Company, has the lease on the building. They're paying $12,000 a year for it. And there's a bank that owns it. It's called the Hawkeye Bank. Well, in November of 86, the Tax Reform Act is enacted, which reestablishes a mint in New York and brings our gold back. So the Hawkeye Bank sends a letter off to the insurance company and says, hey, pay us in gold coin. And so the insurance company says, no way, Jose, we're not going to pay you in gold coin. We're going to pay you with Federal Reserve notes. Case goes to litigation, and the Eighth Circuit says, pay gold coin. Case goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. They remand it back to the Eighth Circuit and say, yeah, we think that's a pretty good decision. And that's the bottom line, Fed. Now, what do you think of that? So here's our gold and silver back. So we're not lacking in gold and silver. And our courts ruled in favor of gold and silver. I'm not disappointed with that. Our U.S. Supreme Court, they split 5-4. I think the decision should have been 9-0, but they said, hey, gun ownership is an individual right. It's not collective. So I think in that case, I think that our Supreme Court worked pretty good. Now, you can sit there and say, well, it didn't work very well for the Exxon Valdez case. Well, you know, I'm not sure that it did or didn't. You can have your opinion. But by and large, when we take a look at Yoder versus Wisconsin, I think that case came out pretty close to correct. When we look at Reynolds versus United States in 1878, I know a lot of people will say, well, that was obvious religious bias against the Mormons. I don't think it was. The case came down 7-0. Reynolds was practicing polygamy in violation of the law, or in violation of the statute. Now, let me show you about this polygamy thing here. I'm going to tell you a story. A guy came up to me one time in Barrister's Inn, and he said, hey, we have a policeman down here in Murray, Utah, has three wives, practicing polygamy, religious free exercise. And the state of Utah is prosecuting him because he's got three wives. And we think that that it's a religious free exercise issue, and we think the court decided incorrectly in Reynolds in 1878. And would you help us with the case? And I said to the man, well, sir, I'm not an expert on polygamy, and I don't know very much about it. And if you want me to, I'll go research it out, and I'll tell you what I think. So I went down to the law library. In those days, I lived in Boise, Idaho. And so Boise is the state capital, and we have a Supreme Court law library right there in the Supreme Court building. And so I jumped in my car and zipped down to the law library, and I had a couple of contacts there in the law library, and I said, gee, I need to research out this polygamy thing. And so there was a young fellow there. I've forgotten his name now, but young man. He had a law degree, and he had a library degree from college. He decided to pursue library rather than law, but he was a pretty good legal researcher, and so he sat me down, got me some information, and I went to work. And when I got through, I was amazed. I just didn't know much about polygamy, but when I got through, you know, I had a pretty good understanding of it. I got into polygamy, you know, back in Blackstone and all the old writers and back in the Bible. There's 24 cases of polygamy in the Bible. I don't know if you knew that or not. It's a social status created by God himself. So when the Mormons were practicing polygamy, they were practicing a scriptural practice which was authorized by the creator of the universe. Now, Christians didn't like polygamy. They were really dead set against it. They thought it was sin and wickedness and all kinds of bad, evil things. But then that's pretty normal for Christians. They practice practices that are just plain criminal. Well, you know, just to give you a little understanding, when I say Christians practice criminal practices, let's just take pork, for instance. In the Bible, God tells us don't eat pig. Christians don't practice that. Hell, they're all out there eating pig in violation of the law, and they're religious people. Now, God tells us not to interracially marry, and that's in Deuteronomy 7, verses 1 through 11, and Ezra 10:10, and there's about 15 scriptures in the Bible that tell us interracial marriage is against the law. Christians don't have any objection to interracial marriage. Hell, they promote it. They're getting to the point today. They don't have any objection to a gay marriage, for crying out loud. Now, sodomy is a capital felony, and it violates Leviticus 20, verse 13. Usury? Hell, the churches are foremost in practicing usury. They have building programs. They borrow money from banks, and then they give you a little card and say, join up with this crime, and it's called the building fund crime, and help us pay this building fund to the bank by paying usury and interest. That violates Exodus 22, verses 25 through 27. Now, I'm not here, you know, knocking you Christians. I don't mean to get you mad at me, you know. I just wanted to point out that you Christians out there, you do not practice the laws of the Bible. In fact, there's 133 laws in the Bible, and you Christians are in violation of 81 of them. No, it's 82. Yeah, 82. I got the list right here. Now, that doesn't mean you're totally wicked and evil. You're practicing 51. But out of 133, you're practicing 51, and you violate 82. Well, you know, it's kind of like my old daddy. He'd give me eight things to do, and I'd do 5 out of 8, or 4 out of 8, or 3 out of 8, or something like that, you know. And then he'd get a little upset, you know. Well, you know, you can understand why God's maybe getting a little upset with us, you know, doing 3 or 4 things out of 8. And he told us to do 8. Now, if you're doing 6 out of 8, that's getting up pretty close to where you can probably squeeze by, you know. 8 out of 8, you know, you're fat city. Now, as a result of that, getting back here to polygamy, I took a look at that and I said, well, the Mormons are right here. The Mormons are practicing polygamy. King David had 6 wives. God never complained about King David having 6 wives. In fact, he got upset with David one time because he was killing a guy and taking his wife. He said, I gave you Saul's wives, plural. You go out here and you kill this guy and take this guy's wife. Jacob had four wives. Abraham had two. He actually had three, but he had two, which were polygamous. And so on. There's 24 cases of polygamy in the Bible. So polygamy is not a scriptural crime, you know, despite what you Christians think. The creator of the universe, God Almighty himself, thought polygamy was a pretty good plan. You Christians have decided that it's a bad plan. That's because, you know, you're pretty well convinced that God's full of mistakes and you're trying out here busily trying to fix his mistakes. That's what Christianity, as far as I can tell, is pretty much about. You're fixing God's mistake. You know, God made a mistake over integration, Christmas, pork, Easter, interracial marriage, unjust weights, witchcraft, sodomy, abortion, and adultery, and you're busily fixing his mistakes. So anyway, I said, well, yeah, I'd be interested in looking into this, and so I did, and the guy came up, and he sat down. We were down at Elmer's Pancake House. That's where I used to conduct most of my business, on napkins at Elmer's. So we sat down, and I said, I have a couple, three questions I'd like to ask before we get started here. This policeman with the three wives down here, I said, does he have a marriage license with any of them? He says he's got a marriage license with all three. And I said, perchance, are any of these three wives related, such as cousins or sisters or something like that? And he said, two of them are sisters. I said, okay, thank you very much. Tell me the story. So he went on to tell me the story that he'd married these three women, and they're getting along fine. They don't have any complaints. He's a Murray, Utah policeman, and everything's fine there. They found out he's got these three wives, got mad, fired him. Now they're prosecuting him here for violation of the polygamy laws, and he thinks that it's religious free exercise, and he thinks that the First Amendment, you know, protects him in this, and that Reynolds versus U.S. was a mistake back in 1878. So for that reason, would we help him and put this thing together? And so I said to the man, I said, well, I've done my research, and here's what I found. In the Bible, it's against the law for a man to marry sisters. That's number one. Number two, it's against the law to marry with a marriage license. That's two. And I said, now the state prohibits polygamous marriage, and they don't care about marrying sisters because they don't want you to marry two women, whether they're sisters or not. But in the Bible, you can't marry sisters. And you can't have a marriage license. That's scripturally taboo. And so I said, you can't get there from here. The guy's guilty of polygamy. He's in violation of both the laws of the state, the laws of the United States, and the laws of God, and he's dead on arrival. So there isn't any reason for me to charge you any money, sir, and take on your case because you can't win. And he was very disappointed. Now, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't represent somebody, but as an educator, as a teacher, I can teach you how to go defend this case. I can look up the cases and say, okay, here's the winning argument. Here's the way to go make the presentation. Now, that's education. Now, if you need somebody to represent you, you've got to hire an attorney. And so they went out, and I guess they hired some attorneys. They took this case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, in the final analysis, they lost, which is what I told him was going to happen when we were sitting there over a napkin. I said, you don't need to go there because you can't get there from here. Now, let me tell you another little story about this thing of appellate review and lawyers and one thing and another. See, if a lawyer was honest with a client, and the client comes in and says, here's my trouble, here's my case, and the lawyer looks at it, and he applies the law to the case, he looks at the facts, he should say to the man, sir, you're guilty, you need to plead guilty, throw yourself on the mercy of the court, and repent, and don't do that anymore. But there's no money in that. Being honest doesn't have payday. So the lawyer says, oh my God, what a wonderful case you have. We should take this case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. You're innocent and just pure as the driven snow. You're pearl pure heart here. Yes, I'll take your case. Just give me your money and let's get on with it. And then they go in there and they put up a defense. And sure enough, the court finds him guilty at the lowest level. And he says, well, no, that's a bad decision on the part of the court. Let's take it to appeal. And then you take it to appeal. And then you take it to another appeal and so on. And then you get to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, by the time you do this, if you're an average Joe six-pack and you've got the money, or a doctor or something like that, and you've got the money, it costs you about $250,000 to argue your case through the process clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. It can be less in some cases, but, you know, just plan on $250,000. Now, that's where the money's at, and the big money is in appeal. You know, it costs you $15,000 to do the case at the lower level, then $30,000 for your first appeal, and $60,000 for the second, and $120,000 for the U.S. Supreme Court. And when you add all this up, you know, you're out around $250,000. And then I have many people that call me and say, well, I've already spent $100,000 or $150,000 or $200,000 on this, and I can't get resolution. Well, it's because you were guilty to start with. You know, I just have to tell you that when people come here to law school and they tell me, here's what my case is, and I look at their case and I say, you know, I'm sorry to report this, but, you know, you're guilty. when somebody comes in here with a tax case, you know, and they've got a social security number, bank accounts, and they've made $100,000 and they didn't file their tax return. I mean, come on. Come on, guys, let's wake up here. Now, I understand that you got sucked into some tax protest scheme and you're involved in something maybe you don't understand and so on. That happens. And if you go into the prosecutor and you say, look, I made a mistake here and I need to correct this, he'll listen to you. He's probably going to burn you, but he won't burn you near as bad as you're going to get burned if you follow this thing through. Now, this guy, I don't know what his penalty was, but I noticed in the literature he lost his case. Now, let's go back here to Reynolds. Reynolds lost his case not because the Supreme Court was corrupt. That wasn't it. Reynolds didn't plead his case correctly. In 1876, Congress enacted a law which was probably aimed at the Mormons that said, thou shalt not practice polygamy. And I don't deny that. That's corruption. I mean, what the hell did anybody care about whether these people practice polygamy? It's scriptural. It's the Christians that were bummed out. They didn't like it. The religious people said, we need a law. So it was a religious law passed by Christians against Mormons. Now, the Mormons weren't at any great loss here. I have students today that have five wives. Nobody's bothering them. They're practicing polygamy openly. Polygamy is not against the law in the United States. You can practice it. But you can't practice polygamy with a marriage license. Now, we don't know, reading the Reynolds case, whether Reynolds had a marriage license or not. I kind of doubt that he did, but he didn't plead out of the fiction of law. He pled not guilty. He came into court, pled not guilty to a charge of polygamy. The presumption of law is that he had a marriage license. Had he walked in and said, hey, wait a minute, this court doesn't have jurisdiction, I don't have a marriage license. Well, have you got two wives? Yeah. Well, you're practicing polygamy. No, I'm practicing fornication. See, they had a witness against him, and then the witness pled the case correctly. On cross-examination, he was asked, well, do you have two wives? And the guy said, no. Well, do you have sex with two women? He said, yes. Well, what do you call that? He said, fornication. Nobody in America cares if you're having sexual relations with two women. But God help you now if you've got two wives. If you've got two wives out here with two marriage licenses, you're dead on arrival. So if you're going to practice polygamy, you go out and you marry privately, and you record your marriages in your Bible. Now, I'm not recommending polygamy, believe me, boys and girls. In the cases in the Bible, almost all of them that I see are dysfunctional. But there is a reason for practicing polygamy. There's a reason for polygamy being in the Bible. And there's a reason for God authorizing it and defending it. But it's not because of sex. Now, sex is a collateral issue. It has to do with business. Polygamy is a business model. It is the equivalent of a vertically integrated corporation. And that's the purpose for it, and that's what it serves. Hey, hang on here. I got to give you a reminder. We'll come back, and I'll tell you about this vertically integrated corporation story when we come back. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements and recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or this local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then we invite you to go to our website, georgegordon.org. ORG, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are talking about story time, and a guy named Don Hewitt, the executive editor of 60 Minutes, he said the best way to teach is through a story, and everybody wants to hear a story. Everybody likes stories. Little kids, you know, mommy, tell me a story. Daddy, read me a story. And in fact, in the Bible, we find that it's the basic modality for education, basic modality for instruction. Tell them a story. So when we get to Proverbs, remember I told you about Proverbs, wisdom comes from understanding, and understanding from knowledge. So we want knowledge, understanding, and wisdom rather than memorization, rote, and indoctrination. All right, now, oftentimes when we go into stories and we're going to tell a story, that story is for the purposes of instruction in understanding and wisdom. That's the modality. That's our purpose. So I'm going to tell you this story on polygamy and vertically integrated corporations to increase your understanding so that over time, you know, you can apply that knowledge, understanding, and then see that there's an outcome that comes from it. That's where wisdom comes from, being able to foresee the future. If I do this, what's going to happen? And then in our educational system, as it applies to law, you know, young people evidently don't have the wisdom to understand the outcome from drug dealing on the streets. That, you know, yeah, there's good money in it, and I don't deny that, but you know, you get caught doing that, you may spend 5, 10, 15 years in prison. Now, do you want to risk the prison time that is probable or possible based upon the amount of money that you're going to be making here? So it's a choice that people have to make, and they make those choices, and then some people end up in prisons and some people don't. I had to make that choice, and my choice was I don't think I want to deal drugs. Now, I had to make a choice over this thing of polygamy. Do I want to have two wives or one? And my conclusion was I think one's plenty. I don't want to practice polygamy. But that doesn't mean that polygamy is illegal, immoral, or that God disapproves it. Now, the God of Utah disapproves of polygamy, and the God of Washington, D.C. disapproves of polygamy, but the God of creation does not. So when the Mormons were practicing polygamy, they were practicing a biblically, a scripturally correct law. And I think they were even practicing it correctly as it relates to the number of wives and the way you treat them and the way you deal with them. Now, the man in Murray, Utah, did not. He had a marriage license and married sisters. Now, I've got to tell you, the Bible tells you don't marry sisters. It's against the law. And the Bible tells you you can't have a contract with a foreign and alien god like Utah. Now, that's the way it works. So you could practice polygamy, and you could get contrary to the laws of God and contrary to the laws of Utah and contrary to the laws of Washington. I don't think that's a very good practice. Now, it is not contrary to the laws of Utah or Washington to have sexual relations with 2, 5, or 9 women. Nobody cares. What they care about is that you went out here and got a marriage license and married these 2, 5, or 9 women. Now, they're not going to sit still for that. And if you did that, God isn't going to sit still for it. He's mad at you because you got a marriage license, and the state's mad at you because you got a marriage license and married 2, or 5, or 9. So now you got everybody mad at you. All the gods are mad at you. So let's make peace with one or two of them. Now, I've got some pretty successful polygamous students here. And then once they got squared around with the law, or squared away with the law, they'll have 2 or 3 wives. And then they don't have any marriage licenses. And then they don't have any birth certificates. And they're not on welfare. And they're not on food stamps. Now, you know, the minute you walk in here and you start getting welfare and food stamps for these 5, 7, or 9 wives, which is what the government's ticked off about, well, they're just asking for trouble. Now, I said we're going to talk about vertical integration here. Well, the reason for vertical integration is because it's a business model. It doesn't have anything to do with sex. Sex is the frosting on the cake. And here's the way this game is played. I had a guy come in one time, and I won't mention his name here, but he had a pretty prominent businessman there in Salt Lake City. He had 5 wives. Now, I didn't know he had 5 wives, but he called one day at Barrister's Inn. He says, I got a problem with my trucking company in Page, Arizona. And he said, I need some help with that, and could I come up, and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, come on up. So he came up, and he had his wife with him, and we went over to Elmer's, you know, the place where we get the napkin out, and we start talking law, and we're sitting there, and he said, let me introduce you to my first wife, Betty. Now, there's a joke out there, you know, this is my first wife, Betty. Well, in most people's cases, that's their only wife, but in this guy's case, it wasn't. And so pretty soon he's talking about his second wife, Joan, and his third wife, Susan, and his fourth wife and fifth wife, and come to find out the guy's got 15 sons, 5 wives. He has a vertically integrated patriarchal family, and he has 15 businesses. Now, one of the businesses was the Sand and Gravel Company in Murray, Utah, which is a pretty damn big operation. Then he has a trucking company in Page, Arizona, and he's got a dairy in Spanish Fork, and he's got a number of construction company and, you know, all these various businesses. Now, he's got a son that runs each one of these businesses. Now, to show you how this works, let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that the dairy farm in Spanish Fork wants to build a barn. What construction company do you think they're going to hire? Do you think they're going to put that out to competitive bid, or do you think they're just going to hire the construction company that this guy owns? Let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that the sand and gravel company needs to haul a truckload of cement from Lovelock, Nevada, up to Murray, Utah. What trucking company do you think they're going to use? They're going to use their trucking company. That's what vertical integration means. And it's very profitable, and it works like a shot, and it's directed from the top down. And Henry Ford pioneered that. For instance, Henry Ford in 1913 woke up one day and he says, you know, I buy a lot of steel, and it costs $30 a ton for me to buy this steel. I would have a greater competitive advantage if I were to buy a steel mill. So he did. He went over to Gary, Indiana, bought a steel mill. And now he's got steel that he produces in his own steel mill for $15 a ton that he can now sell to his automobile company for $15 a ton because that's what it costs him to produce it. Now he can reduce his prices and more effectively compete with General Motors, can't he? One day Henry Ford wakes up and he says, gee, I use a lot of iron ore in my steel mill. It would benefit me if I had an iron mine. So he goes up to the Mesabi Range, buys an iron mine, and now he's got his own iron ore that he can melt down in his own steel mill. And now he doesn't have to buy iron ore out here in the marketplace, you know, for $2 a ton. He can mine his own for 50 cents a ton. One day, Henry wakes up and he says, you know, I spend a lot of money hauling my iron ore from the Mesabi Range down here to my steel mill in Gary, Indiana. So he goes out and buys some ore carriers. To this day, the Ford Motor Company makes their own steel, hauls their own iron ore out of their own iron mines. That's called vertical integration. Gives them a competitive advantage. And they're the only outfit that didn't take TARP money. Remember, they didn't need to get bailed out. Ford Motor Company is pretty solvent. At least we think they are, and they don't have any firsthand information, but apparently they are. Now, that's what vertical integration does in a polygamous family. The purpose for polygamy is business. For instance, here, let's suppose that I've got a son. And I say, son, it would be very advantageous for you to marry one of the Wallace girls. And that's because Wallace is my neighbor, and he has land next to me, and he also has 14 farms. So, you know, for the Gordon farm to be lined up with the Wallace farm, in the next generation, you know, there would be more farms and more land. So that would be advantageous from a business perspective. Now, King Solomon had married, you know, 1,000 women. I think he had, you know, something like 300 wives and 700 concubines. Now, you need to understand that a concubine is a wife. So if you thought that a concubine was a mistress, well, you're near. That's not true. Solomon was not breaking any laws when he had 1,000 wives. He violated a law that prohibited him from multiplying wives to himself. Kings are prohibited from multiplying wives to themselves. Warren Buffett could multiply wives to himself, but President Obama cannot. He's prohibited from multiplying wives to himself. Solomon violated the law against multiplying wives to himself, but he didn't violate the polygamy statutes. He wasn't practicing adultery. But the reason for marrying all these women was for economic reasons. You know, when you marry a woman and she's got a lot of money, Queen Victoria used to do this. She would marry off a cousin or a nephew or a niece or something like that to some royal family in another country. Like she might marry off her niece in Holland to a nephew in Germany for the purposes of business. She was great at that, and she created peace in her time, you know, in the 19th century. You know, the Europeans were pretty much at peace with one another. Not totally, but, you know, pretty much. And so Queen Victoria was good at that. Now, Christians, they don't want to practice polygamy, and you don't have to. There's no law that says you have to have two wives. Polygamy is an unusual practice. It's for business, not necessarily only business, but primarily for business. And it's uncommon in that it's expensive. You have to have money to support two, three, or five wives. I mean, it's like airplanes, you know. You can be flying a Taylor craft, but, you know, if you want to move up to a retractable gear like a Mooney, you know, it costs more money. And by the time you put a second engine out there, you know, two engines, you know, burn twice as much gas. Two wives cost twice as much. By the time you get up there to four engines out there, you know, that thing, you know, it's powerful. No doubt about that, but that thing's sucking up a lot of fuel. So the more wives you have, then the more money it costs, and so the economics of it require that these women need to be out here making you money. It's all right to be flying a Mooney with a single engine, and it's all right to be flying, you know, a Twin Beach. But you've got to be making more money with the Twin Beach than you're making with the Mooney. And by the time you get up to a DC-6, you know, that thing, you know, it takes 6,000 gallons of fuel to fly one of those things. You got to put some people in there that are paying passengers in order to justify burning that kind of gas. Same thing here. You know what? This guy, he's got five wives. That's why he's got 15 sons and 15 businesses that are all pouring money into this. This is a private, vertically integrated, patriarchal corporation. That's what polygamy is all about. It's business. And the reason that the United States government needed to curb polygamy in Utah was because those people out there were threatening the corporate structure of America. And they didn't want that. You can't control families, but what you do is you control corporations under Hale versus Hinkle, for instance. So the political powers do not want polygamy. They want corporations. Now, the people of Utah did not know how to practice polygamy without getting crosswise with the United States government. All they needed was no marriage licenses. Don't make contracts with the government. Now, there's four statutes in the Bible that warn us about that. It says, do not make contracts with the government, with these foreign and alien gods, is the way it's worded. And so we're out here making marriage licenses and driver's licenses and business licenses and professional licenses. And then we wonder why we have to pay income tax, and OSHA, EPA, and the State Tax Commission, and all these government agencies are raising hell with us. It's because the businessman in a regulated enterprise consents to that regulation. That's right. Salmita Sanchez. Remember? He consents to it. Comes into Colonnade Catering Corporation. Now, if you want to be private, then you have to be private. If you want to practice polygamy, that's fine, but it's got to be private. You can't do it publicly with marriage licenses. If you don't want to pay the income tax, you can't have income. Tax protesters want to have income and not pay the income tax. Polygamists want to practice polygamy with marriage licenses and welfare and food stamps. And you can't do that. I always tell a student when he comes in here, I said, you need to come to a conclusion. Are you on the right side of the issue or the left side? Because when we take this into court, the judge is going to apply the law and the facts to this case, and he's going to come to a conclusion. Hell, you're on the wrong side of the issue. And so when the Supreme Court looked at the Reynolds case and the way that it was pled and argued, their conclusion was Reynolds had a marriage license with one or both of the two women. He was practicing polygamy. He was in violation of the statute. Therefore, he's guilty. End of the report. Had Reynolds pled his case correctly, he would have demurred. Had he demurred, he would have come in and said, I don't have a marriage license. The court doesn't have jurisdiction. And then we would have argued a different issue. If he doesn't have a marriage license, he's not in violation of the statute. And the government's chief witness against him, who also had two wives, said he wasn't married to the two wives, that he was practicing fornication. Well, boys and girls, you can practice fornication all day long. Nobody cares about that. They just care about how many wives you got. So now I said I'm not endorsing polygamy. A lot of you guys out there, you know, say, well, I think I'll go out and get two or three wives. Before you do that, don't you think you ought to learn the laws concerning polygamy from the scripture before you get involved in that? Most of the guys that come in here, what they've got in mind is sex. They've been watching television. They want a second wife because they don't like the first one. Well, that's not a very good reason to do that. Business is the better reason to be doing that. Now, if you've got a second woman over here that's got $1 million, or she's got a business, she's got something cooking over here, yeah, she could be worth marrying. There could be a reason for that. Is it going to benefit your business? But you need to understand that it's the first wife that picks the second wife. You don't just walk out here and pick the wife over here, you know. Now, that's one of the restrictions. There are others. You can't just announce to your wife that you're bringing in a second or third woman. You can't have these women in the same house, you know. I see you guys out there, and you've got two or three women in the same house. My granny explained that to me when I was a tyke. She said, there isn't a house built wide enough for two women. There's just no way in hell that you can put two women in the same house. They're not going to get along. So that being the case, each one of these wives has to be the matriarch of her own family in her own house. So that's another restriction on it. I mean, there's quite a bit to this thing of polygamy. Now, I don't want to tell you the polygamy story here. I just want to tell you the vertical integration story. And I want to show you something here about this concept of the judicial system, the courts. They're not ruling incorrectly. They're not mad at you and taking advantage of you over here, and they're corrupt and wicked and evil. I mean, that's what we think. That's what we claim. That's what we say. And in some cases, it's probably true. But it's the exception. It's not the rule. You're not going to find the average Joe Sixpack judge out here is against you for whatever reason, and he's ruling against you for this, that, or some other reason. And that's what people tell me, like the Murray, Utah policeman with the three wives. He's going to go to his grave believing that the courts are corrupt and they ruled against him and they hate Jesus. And that's not the case at all. The guy had marriage licenses with three women, clearly in violation of the laws of Utah and the United States. He's married to two sisters, which violates the law of God, and the marriage licenses violate the law of God. Hell, he's in violation of everybody's law. He's out here. He's not an anarchist, because an anarchist is a guy that doesn't want any government, but he's opposed to the government of God, the government of Utah, and the government of the United States. He's got his own law sitting out here. Well, you can't do that. All of us are under somebody's law. Now, my dad explained it to me this way. He said, son, there's always going to be somebody telling you what to do. Now, none of us like somebody telling us what to do. But look, when you're born, you don't have any say-so over it, and so your mommy and daddy tell you what to do. Pretty soon you get tired of that, and you say, I'm leaving home. So you go join the Army. Well, okay, well, now you've just changed mommy and daddy for a sergeant to tell you what to do. Pretty soon you say, well, I'm tired of this damn Army thing. I'm going to go out and get a job. Well, now you got the foreman telling you what to do. Now I'm going to go get a driver's license. Now you got the highway patrolman telling you what to do. It doesn't make any difference where you go and what you do. There's always going to be somebody telling you what to do. There's only one exception to that. God Almighty, the guy, the Father. God the Father at the top of the pyramid is the only guy in the universe that doesn't have somebody telling him what to do. Now, that's the bottom line. So that being the case, make up your mind then that you're going to have to follow either the law of God or the law of Utah or the law of the United States. There's always going to be somebody out there telling you what to do. The correct choice, according to your Creator, is let God be the guy that tells you what to do. He tells you that in Proverbs. He says, hey, lend your ear. Now, let me tell you what to do. I'll tell you how this thing comes down. And I've got some rules over here. They're a little better than the average state or federal government. And, but that does not mean that it's anarchy or that you can just do as you damn well please. So tuck that one away in your heart. And that's what we're dealing with here with legal quotations when we're talking about decisions that courts make. You're going to be amazed at how often these courts are making these decisions in favor of the little guys down here at the bottom of the pond. Little guys like us, just like you and me. And they're not near as corrupt as you think they are. Next time we'll take a look at some more of those. Hey, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to give you a reminder here that you're listening to the Law Hour and editorial review that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log, schedule, and archives. All of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs